Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. As a young girl, psychologist Mary Pfeiffer felt empty inside. She called herself a good little helper, always doing what was expected of her. But when reviving Ophelia, a book about how to help adolescent girls search for their true identity, when that book catapulted her to literary fame, Pfeiffer discovered that her own identity needed saving. After the life-changing success of reviving Ophelia, Pfeiffer broke down. She struggled with depression, self-acceptance, love, understanding, and happiness. Joining me now is Mary Pfeiffer, a woman who would probably describe herself as more accepting and perhaps more loving than at any other time in her life. Mary, is that a fair description?
Well, hello, Dan. It's nice to be on your show.
Yeah, thank you.
I would definitely say at this moment in time, knock on wood, I'm just in a wonderful phase of life, both in terms of my inner life and having a sense that I have a newfound peace and joy in my daily life, and also just in terms of external circumstances. I'm living in a home I love to live in, and my children, my adult children, live nearby, and I've got a grandchild on the way, and I'm writing, and that's as happy as life can get for me. Right. So I'm in a very good place. You know, I want to say something about your introduction of
Please.
Me, because you said I had a breakdown, and I did have a breakdown in the sense I hit the wall, and I reached a point in my life where my capacity to cope was less than the external demands on my life, and I had a particular day when I realized that was true, which we can talk about later. But the one thing I wanted to say about my breakdown is it was a very polite breakdown, and nobody knew it except my husband and myself. I didn't tell my closest friends or my children. I kept performing my duties for the most part. And the reason I want to make that point is I think we never know who among us is really quietly falling apart. I think it's a common phenomena that despair in this country is prevalent, if not universal, and that what happened to me is in fact not a unique event, but a quite common event in the lives of adults.
Let me, I'm inclined to agree with you, especially in today's world where there's more alienation and more isolation. But I want to ask you, let me pick up on that point. You are a psychologist, and most of us are pretty open and comfortable talking about one's internal lives, even our own.
Right.
And you had this big support system around you. Why did you keep it to yourself? Do you know?
You know, one of the things that was happening at that point was I was very successful in terms of how I looked to the world. I had a New York Times bestseller. Many of my friends are writers who have struggled their whole lives to get a small book in print or a small chapbook of poetry. And so I, in a sense, felt guilty that I was having a hard time because the external world, the people I knew, felt I was so extraordinarily lucky beyond anything they could imagine. And so there was a sense in which I felt I should be happy. And at one point, in fact, I even told a friend, I'm theoretically happy. And she laughed and she said, I don't think you can be theoretically happy any more than you can be theoretically angry. You're angry or you're happy. Those are states. So that was part of it. The other thing is, and this is also, I think, a quite common thing, is the kinds of things that were causing me trouble were things that most of my friends had never experienced. For example, it's very hard to explain to someone that getting on an airplane and flying to San Francisco to work for a few days is stressful. Most people, when they think of travel, think of wonderful experiences. Or when they think of San Francisco, they think of the cable cars and the sea lions at Pier 39 and so on. And my experiences were quite different. And there was a kind of a feeling of isolation, that what I was suffering was so odd and so unusual that people wouldn't explain it,
well,
and that I couldn't expect people to understand it.
Well, that's a variation on what any of us who've experienced clinical depression feel. I mean, when I had my clinical depression, you know, the language I used to describe it for myself was different, but, you know, my language was, if anybody knew how crazy I felt inside, you know, mm-hmm. I'd never be able to practice again. So
right. I think that's true, that part of what happens with a serious depression is a feeling that what's happening inside oneself is not socially acceptable, and that it's not something you can share. And, you know, what I did is, I think what many people do is they withdraw. But, you know, my withdrawal, it's interesting because as a psychologist, my knee-jerk reaction to the word withdrawal would be, oh, that's bad, you know. But actually, my withdrawal was very, very helpful to me in terms of, I'd been a very public person. I'd been constantly, either with large crowds or in airports or on the phone doing interviews. And so a few months of really being at home and just writing and patting my cat and taking long walks and drinking tea, meditating, I began to meditate at that point, was very helpful to me. You know, Dan, if you don't mind, we might go back to the moment in time when I realized I was in trouble, because it kind of explains a lot about what happened to me afterwards.
Yeah, I do want to go back. I want to go back to the beginning, go back to basics. I also want to share our phone number with our listeners in case anyone wants to join the conversation. We're talking with Mary Pfeiffer, a well-known name, author of Reviving Ophelia. Her new book is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the World's of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What you're describing, Mary, sounds like clinical depression. I mean, what you're experiencing has all the earmarks of clinical depression, but this wasn't your first episode of clinical depression, was it?
Well, you know, I had three times in my life when I'd been depressed before. One of them was when I was a girl. I was 6 years old, and I had to spend a year without my mother. And I was very, very close to my mother. And so this year that my father took one of my brothers and me, and we lived in a trailer behind one of my aunt's houses in the Ozarks while my mother was in Denver finishing medical school. That was the year I was depressed. I couldn't have said it that way at six. And then the year I was in college in 18, my father had a serious stroke and never recovered. He was crippled and blind, and I really had trouble with that, and was even hospitalized by a very kind doctor. I went in finals week that semester my dad had his stroke, and I just couldn't get organized to study. I was just so anxious and upset. And he checked me into the hospital with a respiratory infection. And I didn't get any therapy. I didn't get any pills. But I had a couple days where I had nurses bringing me chicken soup and tea, and I could just rest and study. And so that was probably a depression. And then I had an event where a very close friend of mine, 27-year-old soccer player, died of a brain tumor. And that took me down. But, you know, one of the differences between those three incidents and what happened to me the winter of 2003 is when I had a fairly serious clinical depression, was I could explain all those. I mean, I was away from my mother. Mm. A friend died. My father had a severe stroke. And this one was harder to explain to myself. I couldn't quite understand it. I had, you know, Teresa de Avila said, beware of answered prayers. They cause much more pain than those that go unanswered. And I really had answered prayers. I was just successful beyond my wildest dreams. So that it was very hard to explain. If you're having this wonderful, successful life, why are you so depressed?
We should say that research that has come out after, research over the last decade, we now know that with every episode of depression you have, you're at increased risk for another episode of depression. and it's going to take less to trigger it.
I think that's true. You know, the other thing that I really wanted to say about that episode, though, is what I found, and this may not be your experience, Dan, but what I found was that as a psychologist, first of all, I could not treat myself. The brain that got me in trouble was not the brain that could cure me, in a sense. I knew how to treat depression. I knew exactly what I would do for a client with my situation. And I did those things. You know, I exercised, I watched comedy movies, I took good care of myself in terms of healthy diet and trying to be good to myself.
Did you take medication? Do you believe in that?
I did take medication at that point for the first time in my life. I'd never been on antidepressants, and I did take antidepressants, which was very hard for me, but I did, and they were helpful. They were tremendously helpful. But what I wanted to say is when I defined myself in mental health terms, I felt pathological. I felt sick, and it wasn't particularly useful for me because I was already struggling with that feeling of being different and isolated. But when I started reading Buddhism and began to define myself in more spiritual terms, and when I, for example, one of the things that I found deeply comforting about Buddhism was the basic idea that life is suffering and that we all have minds that are very difficult to control, and that the struggles I have as a person are the general struggles of the human race. And so whereas feeling depressed made me feel a sort of oddly pathological and isolated from other people, when I begin meditating with a Buddhist group and reading Buddhist writing every day, I felt calmer, I felt more connected, and I felt that the way I was approaching my healing, which was by meditating and reading and so on, Buddhism, was bringing me, in a sense, into the human race. And I realized that essentially what I'd felt guilty about many things, you know, that I had let people down, that I have always been someone who liked to take care of people. And I have always tried to take very good care of everyone in my world, whether it was clients or family or neighbors or friends or nonprofits in my community or whatever. And what happened with Reviving Ophelia and the success of other books in the next years was there were just too many everybodies, and I couldn't keep up. And I never missed the disappointed look on someone's face when I told him I couldn't help him, or the sagging shoulders of someone who walked away when I hadn't spent enough time with them in a book line and so on. And I just was just miserable with the guilt that caused me. But then when I read the Buddhism, I realized that what I was doing was simply committing the crime of being human, and that we all have those feelings of inadequacy and guilt and a desire to be somehow different and better than we are.
I want to come back, though, to your notoriety. I want to get to the Buddhism in just a minute. But I want to get back to this business of notoriety. You used the word pathological. In a way, being famous is pathological. I mean, being surrounded with this kind of praise and accolades is almost like feeding a hungry heart with candy, you know? It's empty calories. Did you feel that you were at risk of beginning to believe some of these labels like guru and savior?
Not a bit. In fact, I really felt, I think, I forget quite how I said the book, but as my public image grew and I had more and more people who were interested in hearing me speak and writing me and contacting me and wanting to do things with me, I really felt, as my public image grew larger, I felt smaller and emptier inside. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, at some point, almost see any connect at all between how I was perceived by the world and who I was. And that, of course, meant that it was time for me to concern myself with my own identity.
I'm curious, how about now? The connection between how you're seen by the world and
I sort of laughingly refer to myself as the happy has-been, and I don't mean by that that I'm totally off the grid, but I've had the luxury the last I'm now starting my ninth book. I've written eight books. And most of the books I've written have been smaller, quieter books than Reviving Ophelia. And I've also done a lot after that winter of my discontent, 2002-2003, I made a lot of changes in my life. I don't do book tours anymore, and I really limit the number of speaking gigs a year. And I've learned to structure my life so that I can, in fact, be very kind and good to everyone that's in it. And so I don't, and I've also done a lot of inner work, and so that my outside, to me, the essence of health is the way one is outside in the behavior, and the way one is inside are congruent. You know, that there's a great congruency between the way I relate to the world and the way I feel inside. And I think that was very unsettling to me at a point when I was exhausted and anxious and suffering terrible insomnia. And I had physical symptoms too, because my mind was kind of telling me, you can do this, you're lucky, you've always been a hard worker. But my body knew I couldn't do it, and I had high blood pressure and heart arrhythmias, and really the physical symptoms were telling me this isn't working for you.
Mary, let's see if we can get a phone call in and before our break. We've got Meredith on the line. Meredith, Hello? Hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, yeah, I was just wondering, it's interesting that I find that a lot of people who are in the psychological field providing services also suffer from different kinds of depression and anxiety themselves. And from the other end, when you're looking for help in a clinical sense, I wonder how much a clinician needs to be at peace with themselves, as you say you are now, to order to be able to provide help for other people.
Right. You know, that's a wonderful question. And, you know, I was a clinician. I closed my office in 2000, but I was a clinician for almost 30 years. And like all other human beings, I had good days and bad days and so on. But I think the essence of a good clinical psychologist or social worker, a good therapist, is that they have a set of skills that allows them to walk into a room, sit down with another person, and say, how are you doing? And pay very close attention. Now, that's a kind of a general statement. And clinicians are like plumbers. You know, there's a third of clinicians that are just excellent, and a third that are middle of the road, and a third that probably should be in a different field. So it isn't like all clinicians are good. And over the years, believe me, I've run into stories of amazing clinicians and stories of people who shouldn't be in the practice.
Well, I would want to challenge something,
mm-hmm,
an assumption that Meredith made, or maybe it was a question. I don't believe we therapists have to be mentally healthy to provide services any more than, you know, a nephrologist can have a kidney infection too, and that's okay. I think the more we are aware of ourselves and our stuff and our neurosis or whatever else is going on, the more we are aware, the better we are, the better we're able to ask that question and then just sit and listen. But I don't think we have to be, quote, normal or free of whatever, you know, our neurosis.
Well, first of all, there aren't any people that are, in my opinion, free of issues. But, you know, to me, the critical things for a good therapist are a genuine love of the human race and sound, practical judgment, good common sense, and an acceptance of people. And then a very high emotional IQ in terms of understanding themselves, understanding the person they're working with, and good communication skills and good problem-solving skills, and then the ability to focus very intently on a person. Mm. And so, you know, obviously, if you're using cocaine, you couldn't do that, you know. And if you are someone who is absolutely you know, out of control mentally, you couldn't do that.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think one thing that often makes therapists better than, you know, therapists who've had a background of some stormy mental health issues is they have great empathy and understanding.
Yeah, well, you know, and most of us know that trauma can often open your heart to being more compassionate to more people more of the time. We've got to take a short break, Mary, and we'll be back in just a minute when we I want to talk to you about a bit about your background and your childhood and what brings you to the place you are. We're talking with psychologist Mary Pfeiffer, best known for her best-selling book, Reviving Ophelia. She's written 8 books. Her most recent one is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Are you overweight, tired, and sleepy during the day? Do you snore at night? You may have sleep apnea. A University of Pennsylvania research study is looking at the effects of sleep apnea treatments in improving risk factors for heart disease. You may qualify for this study if you're between the ages of 18 and 80 and not currently using CPAP. Further details are available by phone at 215-823-7809. Penn supports WHYY.
Journalist T.R. Reid says he wanted to understand how other industrialized democracies provide health care that's universal, affordable, and effective. So he set out on a global tour of doctors' offices and hospitals. The result is his new book, The Healing of America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with T.R. Reid. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Mary Pfeiffer, and we're talking about her most recent book, Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. When I started reading your biography, Mary, I was struck by your age. You're almost exactly the same age as I am. You were born in 47. I was born in 46. And I know your career starts with your interest in caring for young women. And of course, ultimately, we're always taking care of ourselves. In 1947, you were right on the cusp. The women's movement was right around your adolescence. And in the East, where I come from, the girls my age, half of them, were the traditional, you know, either you're a teacher, a secretary, or a housewife. Mm-hmm. And the other half, you know, were part of the women's movement and sought careers and independence. And 2 years earlier, it all would have been different. 2 years later, it was different.
I know.
You were right on the cusp. So what was going on as you were developing in your late adolescence?
Well, first of all, did you live in a city, Dan? Were you in an urban area on the East Coast?
I don't know if you call it urban. I was in Atlantic City, which is a small city about 60 miles from Philadelphia.
Yeah, because one of the big differences, I think, was geographical. And I grew up I graduated from high school in a little town in Kansas. And the women's movement had definitely not hit that town. And I went to KU the summer of 1965. And at that time, the women's movement had not hit the University of Kansas. Now, by the time I graduated from Berkeley in 69, there was a little bit of a women's movement forming. But, you know, I was not raised like most girls. My mother was a very strong physician, and it was never assumed in my family that I would be anything but a doctor. I mean, from the time I was very small, my parents assumed I would be a doctor. And when I went to college, one of the deals was I could go to college if I took pre-med. My folks were not interested in me being a writer or a sociology major or anything else. They wanted me to be a doctor. So, and my father, the situation with that is both my parents had almost starved during the Great Depression. And they both were in the war. They both were fought in World War II. And they'd had hard, hard lives. And their position was that their children were all smart enough to be doctors and lawyers, and that's what they were going to be. And they were going to be able to live decent lives because they could support themselves. And they weren't sexist about that. I mean, my mother was a very proud physician and thought there was nothing a person could do that was better than taking care of people as a doctor. So they thought they were doing me a tremendous favor by encouraging me I would always, you know, probably be a doctor.
Were they, in hindsight?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I actually wanted to be a writer from the time I was very young. And there was a point at which I told my dad, I was about third grade, I'd like to be a writer. I was a voracious reader. I read every book in the little library at my school and at the in the little Beaver City library in my town, which isn't a big brag because it was a very small library. But when I told my dad I'd like to be a writer, he said, "Don't even think about it. You can't make a living at it." And then about that time in school, I wrote my first poem, a sonnet, in which I compared life to the seasons, you know, youth to spring and, mm-hmm. and old age was winter and so on. And the teacher, I was a good student, the teacher gave that back with a big red C on it, and she'd written trite. And between my dad saying I couldn't make a living at it and my making a C in fourth grade in Beaver City on my first work of literature, I just gave up on myself. And even though I was...
Well, let me stop you there. You gave up on... You said you gave up on yourself.
As a writer. That's okay. What I meant. I just decided I won't be a writer. And
I'm listening with psychologist ears.
I was listening. I never took any writing courses or anything like that. I just assumed I would not ever be a writer.
You grew up in a world filled with religion. I'm curious about something you said, that everything changed when you read The Diary of Anne Frank.
Well, you know, I grew up in a world that was mostly white Western Europeans. And it's hard to describe how isolated my childhood is to people who live in the plugged-in world of today. But I was out in a little town that was 4.5 hours from Lincoln, Nebraska. And my biggest town that we went to for orthodontia appointments, and this place got a pizza place in the 50s, and we'd drive, you know, 50-some miles to go get a piece of pizza on Friday night. That town was about 1,200 people, you know. So we just lived in a very rural, isolated area. And before I read Anne Frank, I did not realize there were people who would deliberately kill children. And that book catapulted me into a kind of a questioning of God, because I was raised a Methodist, and my Ozark family was evangelical or Pentecostal, very religious families. And I just always had believed in the concept of a merciful God. But then when I read about the extinction of 6 million Jews, including people like Anne Frank, I just couldn't quite make sense of religion anymore. And that was a process for me of beginning to think more deeply about human suffering. So it was also, by the way, very important for me, not only in terms of my thoughts about religion, but my thoughts about racism. And my dad spoke like Southern men. He used the N-word. My mother was not a racist. She was very, very careful in her language and in her thinking.
So tell us the impact it had on you.
The book, The Diary of Anne Frank?
Yeah.
Well, it made me very conscious that the way people thought about other people could get them killed, and that horrible things came from ordinary people misunderstanding people who were unlike themselves. And so, for example, whereas before in my little town, I'd kind of let it slide and not been very conscious of the ways people talked. You know, a common phrase was Jewing someone down.
Mm-hmm.
And before that book, that particular phrase didn't necessarily evoke anything in me. After that book, it was deeply upsetting to me, anti-Semitism. And one of the things that was really very interesting to me at that point is there was anti-Semitism in my little town, and nobody had ever met anyone Jewish. In fact, I remember thinking to myself, well, if I met someone Jewish, how would I know? You know, I just had so little concept of what it meant to be Jewish.
Mary, that book change the way you think about people.
Right.
And one doesn't really know why she wrote it. Tell me why you wrote this book.
Well, all of my books have been very consciously written with a goal towards a social action or improving the world. I like that Pete Seeger line. He's asked, is this good music? And he goes, what I want to know is what's it good for? And I'm a very much what's it good for person. And so, for example, Reviving Ophelia, what I really wanted to do was understand teenage girls myself and then share what I knew about them in hopes of increasing the culture's moral imagination
and this
around
book,
the lives of adolescent girls.
And this
With
book?
This book, what I really wanted to say is life is hard for everyone. Life is suffering. I wanted to say what Buddha said. And I wanted to say, and here are some ways that I have found to look upon my life, which in some ways is really a quite ordinary life. I happen to have my main stressor being fame and working away from home and so on, but certainly that stressor in general is no different than worrying about a house being foreclosed upon or a husband with Alzheimer's. Those kind of crises trigger trauma, and they trigger growth. And I wanted to say, here is my own experience of building a life and dealing with the ups and downs and coming to terms with my family history, coming to terms with my failures as a human being and my own unique issues. And here's the way that I experienced a crisis and in a sense, turn that into growth.
Mary, so, we're going to have to take a short break.
Sure.
And when we get back, we're going to take some calls and talk about some of the details. We're going to talk more about your connection with Buddhism. We're talking about Mary Pfeiffer, best known, of course, for Reviving Ophelia. She's written 8 books, and her current book is Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We'll take some of your calls to Mary Pfeiffer right after our break. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Drexel University's Goodwin College supports WHYY and provides experience and real-world skills to help students advance in their profession. Drexel's Goodwin College offers programs in emerging fields including human resource development, property management, e-learning leadership, creativity, and educational leadership. Details and a full list of programs at drexel.edu/Goodwin or 888-679-7966. Goodwin College, leading edge learning.
Next time on Tell Me More, sons often grow up to question their father's choices in life. How about when your father is a dope dealer?
It was a victimless crime, Tony. There was no victims. Everybody who you came in contact with was happy.
Writer Tony DeCopel talks about his article, My Father the Dope Dealer. That's next time on Tell Me More. This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Mary Pfeiffer, author of 8 books, including Reviving Ophelia. Her current book is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Colin on the line. Colin, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Mary, I actually heard your interview with Marty Moskowin months ago. And just as glad now to hear it again.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to ask you, particularly with regard to the Buddhism, in the context of meditation Buddhism and the other similar words, what you all think, if anything, with what you think of our usage of the verb to be, particularly with regard to what seems to be a very limiting effect. And you've talked about identity a little bit, and I'm mostly wondering about saying, for example, I am depressed, and this goes through all of our languages, really. I'm just kind of curious if you think anything about it. That's it.
I think that's, you know, as one learns more about Buddhism, as I've learned more about Buddhism, one of the things that's a great relief is to sort of find a way to be on a ledge above one's own experience. And as I do that, often what I experience is not I am depressed, but a sort of a variant of that, which is sadness is now passing through me, or at the moment I'm experiencing these thoughts and feelings, and they become much less identity definers. Then they become just a part of the river of experience that's always flowing through us. And I find that very helpful, by the way. I think one of the best things that I learned through meditation was this ability to get on a little bit of a ledge above my suffering and just simply name it and label it and let it pass on, as opposed to letting the suffering define me.
In one of your interviews, Mary, you said that our nation suffered from post-traumatic stress and multiple addictions. And you've suffered with, at one level, this could be called post-traumatic stress. Do you think our nation needs what you needed?
Well, first of all, when I talk about my own suffering, I really want to put an asterisk there, because my children are alive, my husband is alive, I'm healthy, I have an adequate income, and I have never been traumatized by physical violence and so on and so on. So I don't want to in any way imply my suffering is equal to the suffering of people who've had these horrific experiences that they've had to cope with. But I will say this, in all the years I've been a therapist and a speaker, I have never seen Americans quite as upset as they are right now and in the last year or so. And I think something is happening in this culture that is very unsettling to all of us. And it has to do with the constant 24/7 information flow. It has to do with the polarization of the culture depending on what news media they consume. It has to do with there's something happening inside us, and our old ancient biorhythms are being recalibrated, and that's a really rough thing. Hello?
Yeah. What is it that you think we need? Within reason. I mean, we can't change.
Well, I think,
change,
you know,
culture.
in terms of those kinds of issues, I think one of the most important thing is turning off machines and just having really some periods every day when we can be quiet and we can watch a bird or take a walk or meditate or, you know, sit and enjoy a beautiful song or just simply be with one's partner or a friend and just gently sharing and reflecting on the day. I think all those things are very, very important to people, and that they have less and less of those experiences.
Yes.
As they get busier, and there's just something very crazy happening to time. And I notice it with scheduling that people I used to see all the time, I see much less frequently. I think it's a very important to simplify one's life so that there's time to breathe and there's time to restore these ancient rhythms that are so much a part of health. For example, one thing that seems to help people, and at least in our town, everybody seems to own an animal by now. Pets have become much more popular.
And
I think
we know they're therapeutic.
And they're very therapeutic.
I hate to cut you off, but we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation.
Please.
Let's go to Ben on the line. Ben, hi, you're on Voices.
Yes. I'd like to reflect on your views. I could sympathize greatly. I grew up in a little town called Durango, Colorado, most of my life.
Sure, I know that town.
Yeah, I could sympathize with kind of cultural differences and racism to a degree, not quite, but I work for a predominant hospice in Wilmington, Delaware. I used to run away from my problems by working doubles, 16, taking care of a schizophrenic girlfriend around the clock. And the only thing that could basically help me through anxiety and time wasn't so much going to go get help because, you know, that could hinder my professional career, going to a doctor or getting labeled. So I wanted to save my job was through spirituality. And no matter what religion somebody may think of, you do have to, at times, you do have to look outside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless if it's praying or whatever may be the means of meditating or anything like that, what you do learn is you have to,
you know,
help people and get a response. I think that everybody is connected. And doing this job, it really helped me extremely to realize how short life is, whether if it's 10 minutes or if it's 80 years.
Right.
And I had a lot of tragedy in my life. I had my dad was basically he died, and I went through a suicide and a couple other tragedies. But in reality,
you know,
people
Ben,
need to
what you are talking about is reminds me of a Buddhist parable about making the container bigger. I know, Mary, you alluded to that in your book. It's you know, seeing the world through a wider lens, something I call small mind and big mind, is just seeing that we're part of a context. Mary, there's a vignette in Tuesdays with Maury where Maury tells a story about two waves that are getting ready to crash into the shore. And the wave in front says to the wave in back, "I'm scared," you know. And the wave says to the wave in back, "Are you?" And he says, "No." And the wave in front says, "Well, why aren't you scared? We're about to crash into the shore and we will cease to exist." And the one in back says, "Well, I'm not scared because you think you're a wave and I think I'm part of the ocean." And
that's the context of
making the container bigger. And that sounds like what Ben's done.
Right. I think so, Ben. And I think also it sounds like you're someone like me that's always had a big circle of caring. But what I really learned writing Seeking Peace and going through this crisis was to include myself in that circle and practice the Buddhist skills that the Dalai Lama calls inner disarmament. And so that I invited myself into that circle and gave myself permission to also have the kinds of feelings and needs I was so eager to satisfy in other people. And I hope you, it sounds like you're a wonderful person and that you've transformed the great personal suffering you've had into wisdom and a desire to care for others, which is, I think that we all suffer, but we don't all grow.
Well, I want to be clear here, and I know you are, Mary, but what you had to do was care for yourself. You took all that time off, and that's something you probably hadn't done your whole life.
Absolutely.
But there's a big difference between caring for yourself and becoming self-absorbed and narcissistic, because you still feel great care and compassion for the larger world.
Absolutely. In fact, I think I think it's very hard to totally care for the outer world if inside there is a kind of a total self-abnegation. Because I think actually that the work involved in totally understanding and accepting oneself then translates to the outer world. And instead of responding reactively, instead of blocking out one's own experience because it's not relevant, one's own experience becomes part of the mix in terms of figuring out how to love and care for other people.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Diane waiting to join us. Hi, Diane. You're on Voices.
Hi. This is Diane. I'm from Lansdowne. And, Mary, I just finished reading your book about 2 months ago.
Yes.
And one of the things that really has changed my life, and I'm a really bad Buddhist, too, is the chapter that you wrote about Glad Dave. And the Glad Days idea has just made me look at the little pieces of my life in a different way.
Yes.
So, for example, I just had knee surgery, and I was hobbling around, and I was in great pain. And
Diane, I've got to interrupt you. Is your radio still on in the background?
Yeah.
We're getting background noise from somewhere.
I'm turning it off. And it was like looking and feeling the pain of my knee and then thinking, well, you could have lost your leg, so be glad.
Right.
And that, I find myself in the last several months being able to apply that to so many different things in my life, whether they be little tiny things or, you know, the bigger mishmash that we all
I'm so glad.
And I want to thank you so much for that. It was just a, you know, a wonderful gift.
Well, listen, I want to challenge both of you on this. And Diane, thanks for your call.
Can I go back to the radio?
You can go back to the radio.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks for listening. So here's my challenge to both of you. You know, she said that, you know, when she had leg pain, she was grateful that at least she had a leg. You know, when I have suffered a variety of severe physical problems, if someone would have said that to me, I would have wanted to probably strangle them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm a quadriplegic, and somebody came in my room and said, well, you should be thankful that at least your arms can move. Well, that doesn't make me feel better. You know, that's...
Right. Well, what I would say is everyone comes at a book with their own particular set of needs and point of view. And obviously you and Diane have a very different background. On the other hand, here's what I'm guessing you would agree with, Dan, and that is that one of the best emotions for happiness is gratitude.
Gratitude.
And one of the way I ended the book actually was saying, by now I'm grateful for everything.
Right.
Every experience I have had has made me who I am. And I'm grateful for all the generations of women who carried water and men who fished so that I could be alive today.
And I
think that gratitude serves anyone well, whether it's Diane with her leg or...
Sure.
I'm sure that you're someone who feels a great deal of gratitude for your life.
I do. And I guess my point is that, you know, timing is everything. And that gratitude happens after well-mourned losses.
Absolutely.
Can't happen before the mourning's done.
Well, and the point actually of the Glad Game story in Seeking Peace was that I put on a pair of rose-colored glasses back along Beaver Creek when I was a little girl, and I wore them most of my life, and they served me very well until they didn't. And at that point, after the sort of the events of the winter of 2002, I really had to go deeper and look honestly at the pain in my life. And in the end of that process of self-exploration, which was both glorious and painful, I'm again very grateful, but I'm also more realistic about the things that were harmful to me. I'd pretty much lived a life denying that I'd felt pain up until I couldn't really stop. I couldn't really do it anymore.
In our couple of minutes that we have left, Mary, tell us about your future, cutting down, retiring.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I will never retire because one of the things that happened in this book is I really got very tired of writing about myself and living in my own head, which is what was required to write a book like this. And I had a great turning at the end where I just decided, enough of this. I want to go out and be involved in the world. And I've probably been, since the writing of this book, more involved in social action and working in my community and working for good causes than in many years, because I've just wanted to do it and taken the time for it. But at this point, I've got a new book idea in mind, which I won't share yet. I haven't even sold the book and talked to my editor about it. But I think I'll write a book, and this will be a book for families, I think. It won't be about me at all. It'll be a book for families.
That's always been a pet area of interest for you.
Right, and so I'll do that. And what I'm torn between, and I think this is the problem of many people our age, Dan, is I wake up every morning torn between the desire to savor the world and to save it. That's not my line. That's I believe that's an E.B. White line.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me that just wants to look at the sky, look at the stars, be with my friends, and then there's a part of me that feels a deep need and responsibility to make the world a better place. And so I'm feeling that that will be the great dialectic of my next decade, is savoring versus saving the world.
Yeah, and I wish that dialectic continues, and I hope your great writing continues.
Mary, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. My guest today has been psychologist Mary Pfeiffer. She's written many books and soon to start writing another one. She's best known for reviving Ophelia. Her new book is called Seeking Peace, Chronicles of the Worst Buddhist in the World. Next week on Voices in the Family, we've got a fascinating show. It's going to be on artificial intelligence. Make sure to tune in. We're going to be talking about some cutting-edge stuff that's going on. Join me tomorrow on my blog, philly.com/askdan. We're doing a live web chat on forgiveness. It's a follow-up to my column I published today around Michael Vick. You've heard of him. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org. We'd love to hear from you. And you can get archive edition of Voices in the Family at our website at whyy.org/voices. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Be happy to hear from you. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Our interns, Jonathan Glick. Una Kwan is our volunteer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.